we live in a city that's full of diversity. I wanted to put my culture and my tradition and the heritage that was left to me as an heirloom at the table. But I also want to open a restaurant in Philadelphia. So my restaurant is first a restaurant in Philadelphia. We serve those, that culture and those traditions, but we do it through that vantage point. We do it knowing that this is where we are and the best product is around us.
Behind every amazing flavor is an amazing human who has perfected their craft. Welcome to Flavors Unknown, a series of inspirational conversations with renowned culinary leaders. Discover how their cultural identity shapes their creative process. With your host, Emmanuel.
Welcome to another episode of the Flavors Unknown podcast, where we dive deep into the heart of the American culinary scene, bringing you stories from the kitchens and bars that are defining the country's food identity. I am your host, Emmanuel LaRoche. I have been in the food industry for more than 20 years, both in Europe and in the US. And every other week, I have genuine conversations with acclaimed chefs, pastry chefs, or mixologists from around the country. Today, we are joined by a stellar lineup of Philadelphia finest. Chef Yun Fuentes of Bolo, Chef George Madovsky of Fork, Chef Michael Vincent Ferreri of Irwin's, the innovative bartender Fred Beebe of Post Haste, and the creative pastry chef Amanda Rafalski from Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Each guest brings a unique flavor to the table from the rich heritage of Puerto Rican cuisine and Mediterranean influences to the minimalist approach of Sicilian dishes, sustainable cocktail creations, and desserts that challenge the conventional. This episode is brought to you by Simrise North America and Star Chefs. Get ready to explore the culinary journeys, creative processes, and the inspirations behind their iconic dishes and drinks.
My name is Michael Vincent Ferreri, and I'm the chef owner of Irwin's in the Bach Building in South Philly.
My name is George Madovsky. I'm the executive chef of Fork Restaurant in Old City.
My name is Jun Josue Fuentes Morales. I'm the chef partner of Bolo Restaurant in Philly, Pennsylvania.
My name is Fred Beebe. I am the owner and beverage director and chief beverage enthusiast at Post Haste in East Kensington, Fishtown.
My name is Amanda Rafalski. I'm the pastry chef at Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Rittenhouse.
Okay, very good. So I always curious when I start the conversation is, you know, when you come back to like in time. So when you go back in your childhood and you close your eyes and you think about, you know, the smell or the food that, you know, that was your first experience. So what comes to mind? The flavors, aromas?
For me, it's definitely like tomato sauce cooking. My mom and my dad would always, like, it would just always be around. There would always be tomato sauce at all times, even if it was like frozen in like pint containers for like a quick dinner. Like just that smell of that like kind of acidic, like sweet green flavor of like the tomato kind of cooking with the basil and everything. Garlic and everything is definitely like for me the top one for sure. Yeah, just like, I don't know, like that smell of whenever it's every time you like cook garlic and onions together and everybody's like, that smells really good. It's like, yeah, no shit. Like that, but like mixed with the basil and the tomato, that like fresh flavor is like, I don't know. There's really nothing like it for me. It never gets old.
Okay, George?
With Michael as well. That's something I grew up with. And for being from South Jersey, that was something that I definitely grew up with was the red sauce was always around. In addition, I would say my mom always was like chicken soup, classic chicken noodle was something that she made at least once a week. That was like, and we would eat it like, you know, she was one of those people, big pot, multiple day meal kind of thing. So it was like, I don't know, it was a big favorite of mine growing up.
Okay. So we know, you know, that you have like a Sicilian background, but for you, what's the background of the family?
There's a touch of Italian in there. I wouldn't say it's a dominant part. My mother, I think the person who taught her how to cook mostly was the Italian side of her family. So that's kind of how it made its transition.
For me, that smell memory comes from recaito, like just that sofrito that's built with culantro, lots and lots of garlic, onion, and a very particular pepper that we call in Puerto Rico ají dulce. Cubans call cachucha pepper. It has all the floral notes of like a scotch bonnet or a habanero, but it has none of the heat. And for us, that's just that base and foundation, you know, that just hits the pan first and just captures the room immediately. And then anything else goes on top of it. But that first hit, you know, there's going to be something good cooking tonight.
Very good. And you?
I was raised in a kind of hippy-dippy, new agey household. So my mom tried to get me to eat a lot of like macrobiotic things as a child. So when you said that, the first thing that came up for me was like brown rice and seaweed as like a toddler being like, this is disgusting. I don't know what you're doing to me. So it's a combination of those kind of like macrobiotic and health food, a lot of health food stuff, a lot of like amazake, if you ever had that, like
yeah,
a
you rice, survived.
Japanese rice milk and like kashi and things like that. And then I rebelled against that. So the other half was like me eating like barbecue chicken cutlets at the deli with like terrible shredded iceberg lettuce and like trying to like eat like Hostess garbage when I was leaving school, because then when I went home, I knew I'd have to eat like a block of tofu.
Wow. Okay. And you, Amanda?
Mine's got to be like sweating onions. My grandma started every meal with onions. And so like the whole house would fill out with that smell. And that's the first thing that always comes to mind. Or breakfast with my dad. He would always bacon, eggs, pancakes. So like all those breakfasty smells.
Okay.
Always really happy memories.
So when the, let's say, sweets part, you know, hit your palate and taste buds, you know, because obviously you're a pastry chef now. So I'm just curious.
Oh, man. I try to incorporate a lot of savory into my desserts, honestly. I don't like super sweet, which is kind of weird. Like, I'll eat candy for breakfast, but in like a dessert, like, I want there to be more than just sweet. So I think, like, probably my preteen, early teen, I was trying to compete with my neighbor who baked a lot. So it more stemmed from me just being competitive. And it was something that I enjoyed and leaned more into like the art side of it.
It's interesting because I read about you, yeah, this you know, notion of being competitive. It's interesting that it came out like the first five minutes of our conversation. Yeah. So I guess that's the case. Can you give us an example of when you said you're introducing or you're using a lot of savory notes in your approach to pastry?
Yeah. There was a while ago, I had a carrot cake on the menu and I used pickled eggplant to go with it.
Okay.
I've done desserts with foie before.
With what?
Foie gras.
Okay. My French DNA like that for sure.
Those are like the two. Usually like herbs, getting like some more savory herbs in there just to like a little pop.
Okay. So the fermentation that you are talking about, you know, for the carrot cake, it's like to add what, touch of acidity or? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Very cool. So, and we don't have to do it in the same order. And whoever wants to start, you know, can, of course. Just curious is when suddenly you realize that, you know, yet, you know, cooking or, you know, mixing drinks or, you know, doing desserts and so on were part of, your career, and you know, what was this aha moment that you said, hey, that's what I want to do, you know, as a job?
I love hearing the story of the people that have always felt passionate about something and they pursue it and they achieve, right? But my story was a little bit different. What I was pursuing when I began a career in a McDonald's was to buy myself some Air Jordans. That's all I really wanted. And from there, I met people that were much older than me, and they pursue careers in hotels and things like that. Being from Puerto Rico, it's a pretty common thing to pursue. And I ended up washing dishes, but I didn't see that as being a career for myself. When I was asked in high school what I wanted to study in college, I was already cooking, and it didn't cross my mind that I could just continue that as a career. It was later on that, so I guess from necessity, I began a career in food, in the industry, in many different facets, from delis to, like I said, fast food, high-end restaurants, washing dishes, prepping, and all of that. But I went, and it was towards the end of my college career when I was faced with the reality that I was going to have to start a new career, that I already had, it dawned on me that I had a passion and I had a career that I had set a base and foundation, and I didn't need to start from scratch. And then it was a true aha moment that it made me feel like, wow, all this time I've been putting all these building blocks together that are my life now. That's how I pay rent. So that's where that was my aha moment. It was more realizing all that I had done. I didn't know that I had it already with me, and there it was.
Michael, so for you, what was this aha moment?
So for me, I was lucky to grow up in a household that like fostered creativity. Both my parents were chefs, and they were totally down for me to do anything I wanted, as long as it wasn't being a chef, which is pretty ironic. I think we all knew how that was going to work out. But, you know, I was allowed to be like, do whatever I wanted, and I was never stifled about that. And I was like, I want to go to art school. So I went to art school for fine arts, and I got a degree in painting and photography and journalism. And, you know, I kind of just went with that. And when I said that's what I wanted to do, they were supportive of it and they were all for it. And, you know, they were like, it's going to be a lot of hard work, but like, you can do it. So I did that for a long time after I graduated from college when I moved back home to Rochester, New York. But I always worked in restaurants. Like, it was a skill set I had. If I needed a job, there was always a job, no matter what. And I've always been able to do both. I used to wait tables. I'd miss it sometimes. It's really fun to be able to like connect with a guest like that. But cooking is definitely where my passion lies. You know, that was like in Rochester, New York, not a lot of like, that wasn't my creative outlet. So I didn't see that was possible. Mm-hmm. It was a way for me to make money for my other job that was my creative outlet. Not to say that I wasn't aware of it, you know, but like that wasn't what I had chosen for it. It was more utilitarian. After I had moved to Philadelphia in 2011, I actually started working just right around the corner at Tinto with Yoon, which is crazy. And that was the first time I saw food, like I saw food be plated in front of me, and I was like, what is that? And it was good, which was pretty dope too. So that was really enjoyable to be able to see that. And that's when it started really connecting for me that like, this could be my creative outlet. Because when I moved here, it was like, you know, I was maybe going to go to Temple to get my graduate degree in art, because they have a great degree. They have a great school over there at the Tyler School. And like, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but I figured if I was here, I could do both. And there was always, you know, cooking jobs. So that for me, I think was the biggest one, was just like understanding that this thing that I always had a passion for and everybody always told me I was really good at could also be a creative outlet. So, you know, It's like they're the same. They're okay. Synonymous with each other.
Amanda, what about you?
So I grew up in rural Indiana. And if you are a girl growing up in rural Indiana, when you graduate high school, you go to school for nursing or teaching. Like, that's basically it. So I went to school for teaching. I made it less than a semester. I hated it. I didn't want to do it at all. And so I was talking to a friend and like, well, why don't you go to culinary school? I was like, okay, cool. I'll try that. And so I'm like, being from rural Indiana, I'm like, where is the furthest away I can go? What is the biggest city I can get to? So I went to San Francisco and just like fell in love with the food scene and cooking in general. And that was like when like I realized like this is what I want to do. Like this is amazing. I don't have to be stuck in the role that people tell me I have to do.
And so you went to culinary school there, and mm-hmm. This is where you started working as well and staging or?
No, I mainly had parties. I was lucky. I had a friend who would take me out to dinner at different spots. And that's like where I first had sushi. It's where I had like a lot of my culinary first, because my family very much cooked quick, easy meals out of cans and bags. And so I wasn't exposed to a lot of that. I thought I hated peas until like I worked for Stephanie Izard in Chicago.
Yeah.
Because I had only ever had canned peas. And I learned fresh peas are delicious, even frozen.
How was your experience at the Girl and the Goat in
Chicago? Yeah, I was at Girl and Goat and Little Goat.
And Little Goat, too.
Yeah, okay. It was a lot of fun. It was such like high volume for me. We do like minimum 400 covers a night. And so just very much like grinding plates out. But it was a lot of fun. Stephanie is amazing work for. I've never met somebody who works harder than her. Like she's 9 months pregnant in the kitchen. We're like, can you please go home? But I was exposed to a lot of flavors and techniques there.
What do you remember from that time? Like one of the maybe desserts that, you know, you put together that you are proud of?
And I did, that's where I did the one with foie. So it was a chocolate bouchon with gooseberries, foie marshmallow fluff, and a foie butterscotch caramel situation.
Foie butterscotch?
Yeah.
Wow.
And at Girl and Goat, pig face is like the biggest menu item. Every single night, pig face is the top of the list. And the dessert sold more than pig face. And I was super proud of that.
Okay. George, let's come to you. So what was this aha moment?
I don't know if there was like truly an aha moment. I'm sure a lot of y'all can speak to this as well. Like there's like, you know, when you're a kid, like, yeah, I'm interested in food. Like you maybe yep. like have a moment where you go out to eat and have something that's really tasty, whatever. Then you like maybe make a decision, like you get your first restaurant job and you're like, try something that someone actually seasoned really well. Maybe not you. You grew up with chefs as parents, but but yeah, but like a lot of us maybe didn't. Like my mom still to this day, like doesn't season the food and she just drops salt and pepper because she feels like people should do that themselves. Whatever. But you know what I mean? You go to your first restaurant job, you have someone like really seasoned well and it's super tasty. And you're like, holy wow, this is like what I've been missing out on. And then like, then you go end up at a maybe a little higher end, a higher something that's like really bringing it a little bit more. And you feel it like a little bit more. You're like, wow, this is like really what we can do with just like something so simple or this amazing food or whatever. And then I think like you get into like maybe a little more of a management role and then you are really impacting guest experience and you're like personalizing that experience for the guest. And then it's like, okay, we're doing this thing. We're making like this like personal connection between like us and the guest. And like, for me, I think like all of those chapters, I guess you could say, sorry, all these chapters add up to being like, yeah, this is that book of like how we got where we are. And I think that's pretty amazing. Yeah.
Fred.
That's me.
That's you.
For me, I went to college at a very supportive liberal arts school. It was very like loosely structured. They really wanted you to find your thing. And while I was there, there was a on-campus eatery in the student center that served like garbage, microwaved, like it was like pan-Asian, but really like everything was just coming out of packaging and going into microwaves or into a fryer. And they went out of business while we were there. I mean, you just heard their business model. They, you know, Chef Mike probably quit and they said, all right, we're done. So me and my business partner currently, Gabe Guerrero, who I run Post Haste with, we were reading a lot of Michael Pollan and learning a lot about like global agricultural politics and international trade. And I had come from kind of like a punk background of like learning a lot about the WTO and like big international trade organizations and being like an angry 15-year-old being like, I don't understand the world, but also like the World Bank is the problem. I'm 15. I don't know what I'm talking about. So anyway, this place on campus went out of business and we pitched the school on starting a student-run eatery that was 90% organic and 90% local-ish, give or take. I mean, we did not keep many records of everything or anything. We also had a lot of parties. And so the school gave us some seed money, which, I mean, they owned the student center, they owned the space, they owned everything. Like, it was very much not a business model that related to how the world actually works. But they basically, like, encouraged our idea and got us started. And so we started this on-campus eatery that ethically is very similar to Post Haste mm-hmm. that we run now. But that was very much our aha moment. And my aha moment was saying, oh, I can take these things that I'm really passionate about, that I'm really riled up about, that I'm really like, these seem like gigantic world problems and I'm pissed off about them, but I have no idea how to interact with it and actually like vote with my dollar and actually make an impact in my little community. And I, because of the supportive environment I was in, I was able to see how that could work in reality, and also how food could connect people to their surrounding environment and to the farmers. We worked a lot with the farmers from the farmers market, and we like brought students on little trips to farms in the nearby area and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, all these Stone College kids who just want like, so, you know, a delicious, like we were doing like goat cheese and rosemary focaccia, like flatbread pizza type things. And, you know, little like stoner food for college kids is kind of fancy, because one of the kids who started with us worked in Italian restaurants in his hometown during the summers. So we came back and was like, I know how to make pasta. And we're like, great, we're doing pasta. who's got a spliff? Let's write a recipe. But they supported us and we got to see that come to life. And that really gave me the idea that that's something that you could incorporate into your career and make successful. And
so how did you move from that situation into mixing drinks? And
so after I graduated from there, I was able to get a job at Blue Hill at Stone Barns, because they heard me say basically the same thing I just said. And they were like, oh, hey, that's our thing too. Even though you have zero experience except for running this thing at, I mean, I had worked a lot of jobs, but I didn't, you know, I definitely didn't have Blue Hill experience. But they were like, you can do our like front of the house restaurant management training program where you work in the restaurant. But they kind of like, you know, there were classes involved, and I worked on the farm and was basically like an intern, but kind of paid. But it was a great experience.
How was that experience? Yeah.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience, because I got to see, oh, here's how you do the thing I'm doing, but on like a super professional level. Also, you know, for the first month I was there, my job was only pouring waters for guests, because I was like the lowest of the back waiters. And boy, oh boy, did I mess up pouring waters a lot. Apparently you can really get yelled at a lot for messing up waters. I was like, oh, this is, you know, how serious fine dining restaurants work. And this is very different.
But this is where you think you develop as well and continue this passion for working with, you know, like local purveyors, farmers, you know, like identifying like the right ingredients based on sustainability and all of this.
Yeah, I mean, the experience there was incredible, because it was saying, you know, here is this incredible dish, here are these amazing courses, and also the tomatoes are grown right outside. And also, like, I'm going to take you on like a little mid-course journey to a compost bin in the back where we're sous-viding eggs inside of compost. But then also part of my job was like, you know, on Thursday morning, going out with a pick and a, you know, like a wheelbarrow, and turning all the compost and checking the temps on it and like doing all that stuff. So I really got to see that interaction and how wonderful it was for people. But the other thing I took away from it was realizing how important and wonderful and magical that experience is, but how inaccessible it is for so many people. You know what I mean? Like, we definitely had some very wealthy guests who were awed and wonder and blown over, and I think, you know, took their experience at Blue Hill and then went back into their lives and said, how can I incorporate this? How can I, you know, I'm the chief of something for Nike or something, like how, like, I wonder if this has affected me in any way. There were plenty of those. There are also plenty of just like rich schmucks who were like, I do not care about the name of the cow that this milk came from. Like, I'm trying to impress some people and I don't care about any of this. But either way, it wasn't accessible to regular people. It felt like sustainability and locality was this thing that you could only access at this upper echelon. So that became an important tenet of Post Haste, and what we're trying to do there is doing the same, you know, sourcing parameters as a Blue Hill, doing the same, you know, conscious connection to farms and all that, but not having a price point that is too inaccessible, that regular, you know, people who can go out and spend, you know, $25-$30 on an entree can still experience that and have that and take that with them.
Okay, very good. So I'm going to switch a bit of conversation into, like, you know, the food or drinks and so on. And I'm curious about your sources of inspiration. So I'm guessing for some of you, it's connected to the heritage and, you know, where the concept of the restaurant is based on. But, you know, who wants to start? Because sources of inspiration can come from anywhere. So I'm curious, when you are looking at a new drinks and new dessert, a new dish, you know, what, how do you approach that?
So for me, it's like, it's kind of twofold. Obviously, being inspired by Sicilian cuisine is like, I would say the most paramount. It has like an endless canon of ingredients that you can use. And the storied history of Sicily allows for you to like really draw from so many different like separate cultures that have made Sicily their own. And that for me is like such a great way to show people how Sicilian food is different than Italian food. It's like it is a completely different place. It is not the same in any way, shape, or form. So
give us an example, something that is really different from Italian food.
So there's a lot more like specifically from like Northern Italian food that a lot of Americans are familiar with, or Italian American food for that matter. The food is a lot lighter, the fare is a lot like less heavy. Specifically also, there's a lot of influence from like the Northern African coast and like the Middle Eastern area of the world because of the spice trade. Sicily was like the main artery of the Mediterranean. So all of that stuff went through Sicily first, you know, so you have all these different spices and all these different things that you can use in that cuisine that they don't really, I mean, they do now because it eventually got up there, but like Sicily is kind of synonymous for that. So, you know, for instance, like one of the main things on the western coast of Sicily is couscous. So to them, couscous is the pasta that you eat instead of, you know, all the other classic kinds of pasta. Stuff like that, I think, is really fun to be able to promote and show people. So because it's such a huge canon, like that's a huge sort of inspiration. Separately as well, like, you know, we have a lot of amazing food here in Philadelphia and a lot of really awesome diverse cultural food in Philadelphia that is fun for me to kind of enjoy. Like I enjoy it personally on a level, but then also to understand that like there are a lot of similarities between my kind of food and so many other cultures. So to be able to find that kind of like how Sicilian food is born out of itself is fun. And it's like kind of my responsibility now to like do that here and continue that kind of situation there. For me, those two things are great. Like I love being inspired by like Vietnamese food or like Japanese food. They're very similar to Sicilian food, you know, very seafood driven, very light, very bright flavors, a lot of texture, a lot of herbs and stuff like that. So being able to like see the corollary between the two and try to, you know, use them as sources of inspiration to make like Sicilian food even more different than it already is.
Okay. So can you give us an example maybe of a dish that you have done? And I, you know, sorry to put you on the spot.
No, yeah, totally fine.
Always interesting to hear, you know, an example of that.
So the greatest one I can think of is just like how Sicilians treat crudo. There's a, like they call it like Sicilian style sashimi or whatever. And it's done in a lot of different ways, but it's basically just like the best fish that you can get your hands on like that day, that hour. And then you just cut it very simply and you serve it with the best olive oil and the best lemon and like sometimes caper and red onion. But like, okay, that's it. And like the austere nature of it, like is like required to have the best possible ingredients with the lowest amount of intervention. And it's a very similar idea with like, you know, sushi in Japan. It's the same kind of
idea.
So
it's a little bit, what you're describing is the example of like what tiradito is versus ceviche, for instance.
Yeah, I think it's like, it's just a reverence for ingredient at the end of the day to keep it as simple as possible. And like, if I'm serving you, you know, a sea bass, it should taste like sea bass. It shouldn't taste like all the other that I'm serving it to you with. All the other stuff should lift it up.
Okay.
And oftentimes less is more when it comes to that.
Thank you, Ian. So I saw you nodding when Michael was talking. So I'm guessing
yes,
connects a lot with.
Yeah. So what he's saying is it's beautiful because what happens is that we live in a city that's full of diversity. And this project, what we set forth to do with Bolo was very much what he's expressing. You know, I wanted to put my culture and my tradition and the heritage that was left to me as an heirloom at the table. But I also want to open a restaurant in Philadelphia. So my restaurant is first a restaurant in Philadelphia. We serve that culture and those traditions, but we do it through that vantage point. We do it knowingly or knowing that this is where we are and the best product is around us, like you were saying, my friend. And if I have to search, I have to cross an ocean to go get the product, then I might be not putting at the table that a beautiful ceviche. Right. So I'm going to search for the product here and then I'm going to serve it or cook it through those techniques and that those traditions, you know, and that's what we want to serve at the table. I've always, the best way that I can explain it is that I raise my kids here in Philadelphia and I want them to feel 100% Boricua, but I also want them to feel 100% Philadelphian. And some way, somehow, I want to accomplish that not only with my kids, I want to accomplish it with my food as well. And finding those purveyors and finding the best product available to you is what all chefs strive for, you know, because you can put as many things as you want in the stew and ultimately it's going to taste like something, you know, but it's when that unadulterated product, like you well said, that it's really going to shine through and it's going to show its
best way. Can you give us an example on your menu that you have today that illustrate what you're just describing?
Yeah. There's a lot of little kiosks around the island in Puerto Rico when you're driving around that serve fried goods. And we wanted to have all of them. But of course, you can't, right? You got to save a couple for a special on Fridays. So there is a tiny little corn fritter, right? That's called sorullo or sorullito. And those sorullitos, they're just this tiny little finger nuggets of goodness, right? Somewhere between salty and sweet. And they're just served like that.
Yeah, based on what? Is it like a dough or what?
Yeah, it's a dough made with cornmeal, a little bit of butter. Some folks use a little bit of vegetable lard in there. Lots of sugar. We are Puerto Rican. We love it. And some salt. And you make these fingers and you deep fry them. Some folks stuff them with cheese. And from that, I remembered my mom's mom, my grandma. She would put this Gouda cheese, right? Or queso de bola. That's what they used to call it. She just cut a little piece of it, my grandpa's favorite cheese, right? And she would just hug it with the dough and deep fry them. And we would fight for them, me and my cousins.
So how do you put that on the menu now?
So what I did is, to me, I wanted to serve sorullitos, but then the question was like, oh, but there's beautiful cheese producers around here. Is there something around me that can some way, somehow still feel like home? Or how can we bring it here? And we decided to go with a cheese called Seven Sisters. And it's a beautiful, beautiful cheese. It melts just perfectly all the time. And it's more of a memory than a recipe.
Well, we want to sample some of this.
Let's go.
I'm drooling.
And we serve it with a guava rum sauce because we love guava and cheese together.
Yeah, that's cool.
So that's our mission.
Okay.
So it is so beautiful to hear other chefs in the city having that same train.
I have one more question for both of you because of this, you know, Sicilian background influence and you Puerto Rican. How do you and you know, in the mindset sometimes of food corporation or for us like you know, food ingredient companies, we are looking at those, you know, trends of, you know, new influences that we see in, you know, in the US and so on. And there's always this question that comes to mind, and maybe you are going to say, we don't care. That's not the way how we approach it. But the idea of how do you balance this idea of tradition and, you know, and authenticity with, you know, the reality of day to day of like the people living in Philadelphia. How do you approach this, you know, tradition and modernity?
I mean, yeah, there's a challenge there, right? But I think it has to do with where you decide to compromise, right? For me, what's important is that, you know, and I'm going to tell a story. I'm a storyteller. When Bolo came to New York City in the 40s, the way that he was able to engage with the city was by losing himself, was by stop calling himself Juan Fuentes, and he called himself Johnny, just Johnny. And that was the way that he could engage with the city best. as long as he didn't open his mouth, he was blonde and he had blue eyes. So he goes, no problem. But as soon as he ordered a Cubano, I'm a Cuban sandwich. That's it. So for him, that's how he was able to do it. And I think that we live in a very unique moment in time and place where we can embrace our traditions and our heritage. And that's the mission, finding that balance that you're talking about, because it's also not about just saying me, me, me. It's also about saying, I want to be part of, I want to be as one with everyone else. And that's the beauty of Philadelphia, that diversity, you see it on every menu, you know? So it is important. And to bring it to the table, I think is number one, the guest, you know, there is a constant communication that it's a conversation that we have with the guests every
I think
evening.
It's going back to what you just said before. It's being able to tell a story, you know, because then while you tell the story, when you told the story to us, you know, around the table, we can feel this authenticity, you know, of your family, your heritage. So that's part of, you know, the way how you approach and you share it with your guests.
For sure. And then there's the places that you decide not to, you say, well, this I truly have to search far and beyond so that it stays the way it needs to be. I buy cachucha peppers by the bushel because not everybody buys them around here in Rittenhouse, right? So I have to buy a couple of bushels of it, and then we make our recaito, and then we have to put them in cup containers that I have to buy specifically for this and fill up a whole side of my freezer so that when we make beans, we're doing them the way that we truly intend to do. Sure. So now the ham that we use for those beans, we search around here, the beans we search around here, and that and I mean in the domestic area, right? So that's where the balance is. So where do we not lose ourselves, and how do we find ourselves in with the rest?
So, Michael, you want to add quickly something on this?
Yeah, it's a very similar kind of take. You know, people always ask me, like, what does your food mean to you? And how do you, like, how would you describe your food? And the way that I always describe it is, like, you know, we call it modern Sicilian because it sounds great and it looks, you know, really good. People understand it a lot easier than, like, a long-winded explanation about Sicilian history and culture. But the way that I kind of explain it is, like, during the day when we all cook food together in the kitchen, we are all like 95-year-old nonas, and like that's it. And the way that those things are made, that's how we make it. Like, it might not be like the specific technique that you learned in a different restaurant or this or that, but it's like, it doesn't matter. Like, that's how we do it, because that's how it's been done for hundreds of years. And who the hell am I to change it? Like, that's ridiculous. Now at 5 o'clock, you know, we put our nice aprons on, and we make the food look really pretty, of course, naturally, because, you know, but at the end of the day, the thing I think that draws people the most to it and makes it the most approachable is the fact that while it doesn't necessarily look like your grandma's food, it tastes like your grandma's food. So everybody has that understanding of what that means. Like, I had an Italian grandmother, not everybody did, but everybody knew, I would assume, not everybody, but most people knew some Italian kid. They would go over to his house and they'd be like, damn, your dinner's really good. So everybody has this sort of memory, this idea, this connection to that. And like the best example I can give is in the restaurant during the summer and the fall when we get Sicilian eggplants, which is a special kind of eggplant. We make my great grandmother's eggplant caponata, and it's like one of the most popular dishes on our menu. People love it. Whenever we can get them, it's on the menu no matter what. There's only like 6 people who know how to make it. There's not a written recipe. Like, I showed my now CDC how to make it, and then he showed, you know, now the person who's my sous chef, and yada, yada, yada. You get the idea. You know, everything we make has recipes and grams, and, you know, because it has to be the same. A long time ago, one of my old bosses told me that if you want to make good food, it has to be like fancy McDonald's. Like, it has to be fancy, but it has to be fancy every time, and it has to be the same. Because, like, if somebody's going to come back a year from now and they want that thing, it has to be exactly the same thing that they had last time. And it's a lot harder than you think. So we use all these different techniques to make sure that everything is the same. But for this specific thing, it's like this one spoon that we have in the kitchen that exists for this one part of the dish. Or like you use a 4-quart cambro for the red onions and you use a 4-quart cambro for the celery and you use an 8-quart cambro for the eggplant. And like, that's it. Or like this bowl is for this, or, you know, this ladle, you get the idea, right? So it's like using those like Nona techniques of like just this spoon, how many spoons of it, yada, yada, yada. And it's like, it's the way that we teach people how to understand food and how to listen and see and look and smell and not just use like a computer or a calculator or a scale or whatever. And don't get me wrong, I mean, we use them all the time. But just this idea, and it's like one of the first things that anyone who comes and works in the restaurant like learns how to make, because you have to have that appreciation for it. And I think keeping that is the most important part.
So let's move in on the sweet side. So Amanda, when you approach like a new dessert, you know, what's your source of inspiration?
I kind of pull from all over. Like flavor-wise, I like to focus on what's in season here sometimes. Like in the summer when the farmer's market Rittenhouse on Saturday mornings, like I'll go before work. I'm like, can you set this aside? Can you set that aside? And then chef will come by later with his car and pick it up. But like we had a dessert that was a ghost milk tres leches with berries on top. So you keep the menu description very vague as to what's on top of it, because if the blueberries aren't good, we're not going to put blueberries on it this time. And then my husband's a bartender, and so I've been exposed to like a lot of that side of it, and like the back side of the bar. And I love tropical flavors, and I love tiki drinks and tropical drinks. And so like passion fruit is my all-time favorite flavor. And that with like any kind of spice, like star anise and clove and cinnamon, like all those warm spices. And then I like to like draw from like my French background from working at Brasserie Rollman. And so all those like very classic techniques. So like we had a Babo rum, but it had, instead of rum syrup, it was a pineapple tapache. And so just like trying to like pull these things, like this is something I like, I want to eat. And so we're going to put this on the menu.
So why the tapache, I mean pineapple, yeah, tapache on the babaw rum?
Because I love tropical so much, and I don't really drink a lot. And so I wanted something that was accessible to the people that don't drink as well. And so we would add rum to it later on that is reduced. And so it's not so boozy, but we did have an option available without the alcohol. Mm. Yeah. And then like strong from my childhood too. Like the dessert right now has a brown sugar ice cream on it. I swear to God, it tastes like eating Eggo waffles with syrup. And that just like takes me back to my grandma's kitchen again. Just wake up in the morning, grab some Eggos, throw them in the toaster. And it's just like those core memories. And like I've had servers tell me that the desserts will remind other like guests of their like core childhood memories as well. And that just like brings me so much joy.
I hear as well, like a lot of chefs or pastry assistants saying, oh, I'm following a lot of this one and this one, you know, like chefs, like maybe from Japan or, you know, because now there's the technology and then you can follow them on Instagram and you see the plating and you see things that they are doing. And a lot of people said, oh, okay, I got that inspiration, you know, from following this one.
I struggle with plating. That's definitely like my weak point. I'm like, how do I make this look pretty? Like the flavors are good.
Oh, we looked at you at the menu. I don't know with whom today, with you today, because we said we didn't go there. So we looked at this on the bus and we like at all the your plating. It's wonderful.
Oh, yeah, it takes a lot of time. that's a lot of collaboration too. Like I'll take it to the people in the kitchen with me, like to Garmo, because like, hey, what do you think of this? Like, what would you do differently? So honestly, it's like the people around me inspire me a lot.
Give an example, someone recently that inspired you?
Indy, who is our executive sous chef. We bounce ideas off each other constantly. She'll bring me sauce. What do you think of this? You need more salt, more acid. I'm like, yeah, what do you think of this plate up? Is it too like fussy? Is it too complicated? And sometimes it'll get into service, like the dessert we have on now. The initial plate up was way too fussy, way too complicated, way too many touches. And it just, we went down in flames the first turn. It's like, all right, how do we streamline this steps, but still have it? Yeah.
Okay.
There were too many pieces on the plate. Like, all right, how do we simplify this, pull it back, but still have it like be this beautiful elevated
So which plate. One is it? What dessert is this one?
It's the blood orange upside down cake.
Blood orange upside down cake?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
With blood orange curd, honeycomb candy, kumquat, pickled kumquat, and the brown sugar goat milk ice cream.
So when you are creating like the, let's say a new menu, you know, for the dessert part of the restaurants, so do you try to establish like a connection with, you know, like the savory aspect, the culinary aspect of the menu, or is it like, you know, completely separate? It depends. There's, you know, people that I talk to you know, in terms of pastry chef, sometimes they sit down with the chef. There's a new menu that has been created, you know, on the savory side, and they just want to have kind of a transition and kind of almost like the whole thing, you know, goes together. So just, I'm just curious.
I feel like dishes on a menu change kind of sporadically. It's not just like a clear cut across the board thing. But as stuff comes into season, I feel like we're inspired by a lot of the same flavors. Like, there was something. Yeah. Like with the pickled eggplant, when the eggplant came in, I'm like, oh, I want to use this. And they're like, oh, we want to use this. I'm like, okay, well, what are you using? Because I don't want it to be the last course going into this course. And then it's too much of the same. So there is that flow and that continuity, but it's divided as well. Like it is its own thing.
Okay, very good. Okay, we need to hear about drinks now. We haven't talked about that. So how do you approach like a new drink, you know, at your place?
So the first inspiration and the necessity of the innovation comes from the things that are available locally, because
on the east side of the Mississippi, if I remember correctly.
The east side of the Mississippi, because that is our hard line for sourcing. We, coming from my experience at various farm-to-table restaurants, I was like, farm-to-table is this very abstract idea with no parameters. So part of the main focus of Post-Haste is to say, here is a hard line. Like, we are creating a parameter for ourselves. We want to prove to other people that you can do that. You know what I mean? Like, there are definitely lots of farm-to-table restaurants that get flack for doing amazing things with local sourcing. As I think we're all trying to, you know, draw inspiration and ideas from the bounty that surrounds Philadelphia. But then they'll tout, you know, their local, all this and all that. And then, you know, there's still a Cisco truck backing up once a week and, you know, delivering things to them. So we basically wanted to be a test case to prove you can source everything from the East Coast of the US. So really the first source of inspiration is by necessity. It's, you know, we use kumquats and yuzu and limequats as our main citrus for drinks because we get them from a greenhouse in New Jersey. They also happen to be very like cool and chic and popular right now in culinary, but that's what's available to us. So a lot of times when I need to come up with a new drink, it's because I have run out of the supply of the drinks that I have and realize way too late, oh my God, we're going to run out of this next week. I got to do something. And so I'll go to Head House, check out the farmer's market, see what is in right now. I'll look through our purveyors, see what's in. And then I'll just start grabbing stuff. You know, I'll go over to River Wards, which is luckily right nearby. They purchase from a lot of the same purveyors we do. And I'll pick up some, like, you know, right now I'm picking up purple potatoes and I'm picking up some squash. And I'm like, okay, I got a couple recipes in my back pocket, a couple ideas. Let me start breaking this down and figuring out what the tastes are and then build up a drink from there. And in that way, in terms of like grander inspirations or like things that have influenced me a lot. When I used to work at Momofuku at the Sambar, and the beverage director there was a guy named John DeBerry, and he taught me so much about classic cocktails and classic cocktail structure. And, you know, here's how you make proper classic cocktails, but also here's like the influences from Dave Arnold, who wrote Liquid Intelligence, in terms of like, you know, here's how you properly shake and stir and dilute, and here are ways to acidulate drinks, and here are ways to like all these different scientific techniques and recipes. And so building on that combination of new innovations in terms of like bar techniques and the science behind it, but then also what JDB taught me in terms of like, you know, here's classic cocktail structure and here's how they work. Mm-hmm. 'Cause a lot of our drinks will be, I'll start with an ingredient or I'll start with a loose idea and I'll start messing around with the ingredients and combining them with different things and saying like, what is this, you know, like what is a purple potato when I cook it in this way? What kind of spirit can I imagine with it? What other flavors would be complementary with this? And then I'll look back on classic cocktail recipes and go, what is this kind of feel like, or what direction can I pull this in?
Because but I think as well, I mean, from the discussion we had, and we had a long discussion with you at your place, what was really interesting to me is because of the constraints of ingredients sourced on the east side, you know, of the Mississippi. Is that, you know, there's some classic drinks that you obviously you cannot make with like the classic ingredients. So the example was the dirty martini. Obviously, there's not a lot of olives, you know, that are growing on the east side of Mississippi. So So then in your mind is how am I going to recreate that experience without olives, but with something else, you know, with the brine and so on. So do you have other example like this in terms of constraints that, you know, because of the concept of the place that, you know, that inspire you and impose yeah, sure. you on a certain like, you know, innovation yeah,
yeah,
process?
Yeah. Yeah, there's it's actually something that I'm constantly working on because I feel like it's something that we're going to keep butting up against. So as much as I can get ahead of it and have new innovative solutions, the easier it's going to be for me in the future. So right now we have a Singapore sling on the menu. And so I bought all the ingredients to make a classic Singapore sling. And then was like, okay, cherry herring. I'm not going to be able to get that Benedictine. I'm not going to be able to get that pineapple juice. I'm not going to be able to get that grenadine. I'm not going to be able to get that. So what do I do? And part of the reason why I chose a Singapore sling is because I was sitting on a bunch of cherries infused into Laird's bottled and bond apple brandy that I had just bought. Like when something is really in season, when it's tasting really good, I will just buy like flats of it and normally I have a drink on the menu containing that, but I often end up with too much because I'm like, these are delicious. I'm going to figure it out later. So I had, you know, 20 quarts of cherries in brandy that had just been sitting in the walk-in since, you know, September or October. And I was planning on making with a bunch of them like brandy cherries for, you know, Manhattans. But I have way too many. And I was like, okay, I'm sitting on waste product, as we all know, as people who run P&Ls. I was like, I can make something with this. It's already made and I've already spent the money on it. So that's where the cherry herring idea came from. So I started taste testing the combo of the cherry herring and grenadine versus blending the cherries into the apple brandy and sweetening it and making that taste. And that made the cornerstone. And then because we use kumquats, I basically just did a one-to-one sub kumquats for pineapple, but tried to bring out the most flavor of the cherry to reinforce the fruitiness of the pineapple. And then, you know, the Benedictine, we work with Faccio Bruto from Brooklyn, and they have a mm-hmm. green herbal liqueur. And then it kind of just went from there. And then in terms of other drinks that I'm still trying to get down, the big thing for us is agave. Like we don't, you know, we're working with producers in Pennsylvania who are sourcing distillery strength tequila and proofing it down in Pennsylvania and bottling in Pennsylvania. So it's kind of like a tricky little workaround to our, you know, sourcing from the East Coast. But I'm like, we just opened 9 months ago. I'm trying to run a successful bar. We don't, like, if you come into Post Haste, we don't beat you over the head with all these ethics. Like, this is stuff I love to talk about here. I love to talk about with industry people who are interested. I think it's really important. But, like, I want people to just walk into Post Haste to go, this is a dope bar. I feel cool here. I want to get drinks. Let me have a sexy date. Like, that's it. So we, you know, I am like, people are going to come in, they're going to order margaritas, not knowing what our whole thing is about. So I got to have a solution for that. What I really want the solution to be is I want to make something by combining different infusions and different techniques, something that really replicates the taste of tequila without being tequila, or the taste of mezcal without being mezcal. So I'm constantly doing like infusions of different peppers. I have some ají dulces that I'm infusing. I'm using, you know, but I was like taking like
the corn in his freezer. Yeah, that's
what you can borrow some. No problem.
But I'm taking like corn husks. I was like infusing corn husks and blending them, and like asparagus. Tony, who's downstairs behind the bar, he told me at one point, he was like, oh, did you know like agave is actually in the same family as asparagus? So I was like, great, I'm getting some asparagus. I roasted it. I took fresh ones. I was like, and like it's gonna be like a years long thing because there's no way to really
you
match
have
that.
Too much fun.
but yeah, it's a good time. And now I just have to figure out how to sell some asparagus vodka or whatever I made, because right now I'm sitting on a product loss and I wasted money on it.
Okay, so George, we haven't heard about you, so I don't want to forget.
Yeah, I'm in the
list. So do you want to maybe pick like a dish on your menu and talk to us about the inspiration behind it? So how do you...
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about the whole process. So for me, I am the executive chef of a restaurant that is a very long-standing place. Been there for 27 years. There's been a lot of excellent chefs before me. And when it's my time to leave, there'll be a lot of excellent chefs after me. So, you know, it's a very interesting concept. They're like, I think whoever's been around Philly for a while probably understands what that restaurant is before they get there. You know what I mean? Which is kind of difficult, right? So for me, my mother's half Lebanese. I didn't necessarily grow up with that as like an influence in my childhood. But I've kind of used this palette of the restaurant of Fork to go on this like culinary journey and kind of unpack some of these things that maybe I missed out on and like learn some things. But again, it's a very American restaurant. It's a very contemporary American restaurant. Mm-hmm. I can't just drop hummus on the menu. It's not going to work. But there's a lot of like, we bring in a lot of, you know, baharat and like your Ras Al Hanout and like spices kind of like that, that like maybe wouldn't necessarily find their way there in a classic kind of sense, but it kind of keeps our things very exciting. And I also am a big believer in when you're kind of conceptualizing menus and conceptualizing restaurants, you have to kind of build yourself a sandbox before you can play in it. You know, some of people maybe have that kind of more intuitive being like, you know, Sicilian chef or Puerto Rican chef or whatever, or like super hyper local thing. And that's something that I've been battling with for a long time. When I first got to Fork, there was no sandbox. It was like, you could have done anything and it would have stuck, which is really hard. You know, it's almost, so we've been kind of like paring it down to like, it's only the Eastern Mediterranean kind of coast. And like our sourcing is maybe not as hard line in the sand as y'all. We do source really well. And I do like take my walks through the farmer's market like everybody else and like get really inspired by colors. And like, I also like read a ton, a fuck ton of cookbooks and like,
so I'm going to ask you all like one, in fact, two questions. One is, what is like maybe one flavor, if you can pare it down, that symbolized and represent the most your restaurant? So you, for instance, you know, George at Fork. And then what is like maybe one ingredients of flavors that you are excited that you want to experiment with?
Let me go first.
Yeah.
All right. In the last month, it's been preserved lemons. I've been going everywhere. And like, you know, it's that time of year. We started like, you know, December-ish. We started packing them and, you know, stuff. And now we have like quite a lot. And we just like, they've been finding their way and everything. The juice finds its way into stuff. It's like an amazing product. I mean, like.
Who wants to jump in? Those two questions.
So frito.
So frito
for sure. Yeah, you know. That would be the answer. That's the base. That's the foundation for every dish that we do. But what's been interesting is as we've moved forward, even pre-opening, is discovering different sofritos and different combinations of the same few ingredients that truly change the end product. So a little tweak of the pepper or the garlic, and boom, just a whole different thing. So we've taken it upon ourselves to keep researching so we tried to uncover different sofritos. Recaito, for example, from Puerto Rico, completely raw, combined and then used. And the interesting thing is because the public have developed a palate for it. Some folks use it after the cooking has been done. And there's a certain harshness and bitterness that is just normal from the vegetables that people do enjoy. It's like this tiny little teaspoon at the end. And then there's just so many different ones. We do a Spanish sofrito. We call it rojo. That one, it's red peppers, onions, garlic, again, everything gets roasted with white wine and saffron. And then that gives us a completely different profile when we cook our beans. We do a green sofrito, Cuban based. That one, we use a lot of oregano, cumin, green peppers, Cubanelle peppers on it as well. Lots of onion, lots of garlic, again, roasted. And very interestingly, a gastric of red wine vinegar gets built with brown sugar in it. And that gives this beautiful sort of balance to all the very rich spices that go in there.
It's a fantastic blend. I mean, I remember talking with, in fact, the chef from Philly, you know, Jose Garces, and, you know, talking about sofrito coming from Ecuador or other chefs, you know, from Panama and so on. So you have all those different profiles, you know, a sofrito, which is like a rich, you know, and talking to my DNA French with mirepoix, which is, you know, kind of soft, you know, like connections. But I think you know, all Central America, the Caribbeans and so on, they have such a rich profile on top of what mirepoix can be and all those little nuances and different ingredients that, you know, someone should write sofrito and the different.
For sure. And then profile. You move into different islands that do embrace the spiciness of certain peppers. And then their sofritos are built in that manner. And I truly love that we have, or not have, we are working our way into kind of like finding ourselves in just the base and the foundation of the cooking. But with that said, if I had to talk about a certain ingredient, just one thing, annatto seeds. We use an incredible amount of annatto seeds. And I knew that we used it, but I find myself going to the dry storage and getting more and more and more. We've developed some sazons or based on achiote powder, marinades that we're using that are annatto seed based with different spices. And we cook about a 30-pound jug of oil to make annatto oil at least once a week. It's been a pleasant surprise to see how we have used this tiny little seed that sat on grandma's counter, and we've embraced it that much.
Amanda, what about you?
I think speaking to the pastry menu specifically, it has to be like citrus. So I've said like I don't like overly sweet desserts, so I definitely like a brightness. So
which one?
Which one?
We heard kumquat and yuzu from your person sitting next to you. But
I say right now I'm loving the blood oranges right now. Blood oranges, yeah.
Okay, but that's the one with the upside down cake.
But I try to sneak passion fruit in wherever I can. Always passion fruit. Actually, I've got tattooed on my hand. And then I was recently in London and had dinner at a Akoko, which is West African, and had a dessert that had ouda in it, which is a spice that it's kind of peppery, floral, notes of vanilla.
How do you spell it?
Ouda. It's U-D-A. So as soon as I got back, immediately got a bag of that. I'm like, what do I do with this? I want this. I love this.
Okay.
And so I'm excited to try to.
So you're going to introduce that. So it has like a savory character component?
A little bit, yeah. It's okay. Like kind of like similar like black pepper, but it's like kind of floral and vanilla. I made some ice cream with it and chef's like, oh, it's kind of reminds me of like the bay leaf semifreddo that we
had.
Oh,
wow. So it's, do you know which part of Africa it's coming? Like the west part of Africa?
Yeah, West Africa.
Okay, West Africa. Okay, cool. Michael?
One thing that I would say that like exemplifies the restaurant is definitely citrus as well. You know, it's best obviously right now. But you know, being Sicilian food, like they have the grace of having citrus year round, which must be really nice. And that is something that is like very pervasive in literally all of our food. I would say aside from a garlic allergy, if someone comes into the restaurant and they're like, I'm allergic to oranges. I'm just like, you are in the wrong place. There's literally oranges or lemons on every single thing that you eat. We have at the past, we have lemons to garnish, but we also have oranges to garnish. That sort of like balanced acidity is something that I think is necessary for our food and necessary to represent the island. Right now we have a blood orange salad on the menu. That's like the classic Sicilian blood orange salad. And one of my favorite parts about it is like everywhere you go in Sicily, especially this time of year, like there is someone eating it. So I always tell people at the restaurant, like when you're eating at the restaurant, there's probably someone eating this in Sicily, like at the same time, because it's done like the exact same way. There's really not a lot of difference to it. So I would say citrus.
And there's like a new ingredients that you are interested in, maybe from like Sicily that you discovered that you want to experiment with?
It's kind of hard to pinpoint specific ingredients, but I could say that I am always on a quest to find new ways to represent the agrodolce flavor profile. Agrodolce is like the most Sicilian thing ever. All of their food represents that ideology of sweet and bitter. Sicilians are true believers in that food is life. And to them, if food emulates life, which you have to have the good to have the bad and the bad to have the good, then it is truly what like is what real food is. You know, all of their food exemplifies all of this in many different ways. And that flavor profile to them is very near and dear. But for me, it's like trying. Obviously, you have the classic like honey and vinegar, right? Like everybody knows that it's delicious. Everybody likes, you know, sweet and sour sauce and shit like that. But finding new ways to represent that to the guest in a way where the flavor still hits that certain core part in your brain that like, you know, really loves those flavor profiles, but something different. A great example the other day, I did like Caraflex cabbage from one of the local farms, cured it in salt, a tiny, we call it cauliflower salt because it's a dish that I did at my old restaurant a long time ago, but it's basically like Sicilian Mrs. Dash. So it's like salt, orange zest, black pepper, ground up dried bay leaves, and dried oregano. And it's all just like sits in this like compound salt, and it's just like all the flavors. Oh, and chili, of course. So we cure it with that and a little bit of sugar and foie gras fat. And I let it sit and hang out for like 3 hours on top of the oven and just kind of like marinate. Mm-hmm. And then grill out of the cabbage. So it's like still crunchy, but charred. And then we toss it with a little bit of vinegar, some hazelnuts, and then we just grate kind of white chocolate on top of it. And like at first you're like, this is going to be weird. But when you have them all together, like the bitterness and the grilled or the cabbage and like the white chocolate, you know, it's like such a pleasant thing to eat when you're eating it all together that like, obviously they seem weird. And like, that's the fun part is because when you eat it, it's like, it still hits sure. that sweet and sour part in your brain that you love. So that's kind of the best way I could describe it.
Fred, what about you?
So I have a couple answers for this. I think one thing that exemplifies what we're trying to do and what we're interested in the most is the yuzu and the kumquat and all that we get from New Jersey. And the reason why that exemplifies it is taking something that is not traditionally been grown in the US, but we have the correct climate for it, or we have the correct, you know, setup, and a farmer says, I'm gonna try and grow this, and is now making it on the East Coast and growing it here. And I think that that's a really important thing for our program, but is also just very important for like the diversity of crops in the United States and the diversity of things that are available locally, because we do have like zone 7 that we're in has a very similar climate to many other growing regions. And there are things that are grown in those regions that aren't yet. So like yuzu is a great example of something that was grown in a similar area across Japan and China. And then somebody in New Jersey was like, oh wait, I can do this. And they figured it out. I don't think it was that easy. I don't think they just went, I can do it. But they figured it out. And so now we're the beneficiaries of it. And also we don't have to be importing yuzu from Japan, which I had worked at other cocktail programs that were doing that. And so it's amazing to have those things locally. I think the second thing that's super important to us is anything that we freeze ourselves. So for our yuzu, and I guess this is more for you guys, maybe the podcast will be interested, but for like our yuzu, kumquat, all that, when it comes in a season, it's like, you know, the season is a couple weeks long, maybe a month. So I have to calculate out how many yuzu drinks do I think I'm going to sell for the next year, buy the year's worth of supply from these guys, break them all down over the course of before they go bad in the walk-in, and then store them in the freezer. And so I have a year's worth of kumquat, yuzu, limequat stored in chest freezers in our basement, ready to be turned into super juice. That brings me to the next ingredient, super juice. I talked to you guys about super juice.
I know, yes.
Super juice is incredible. It's amazing. It's the only reason why we can use more expensive product and make juice out of it. So super juicing is an incredible thing, and being able to freeze things and then use them and make a product that stretches longer out of it has been very, very important for our program, but also like just freezing things in general. So like the cherry tomato martini that, you know, as Star Chefs wrote about and that we've gotten a lot of press for, like we were getting tons of local cherry tomatoes in, and then the season started drying up. So I made a ton of the cherry tomato brine, and it's in the chest freezers right now. And we just like defrost it as needed. But using freezing as a preservation technique has been very important to us. Got one more?
I'm thinking about the time too. And sorry, because, you know, we kept you a long time here. But I want to make sure as well, the audience questions.
I think you already asked this, but do you guys, I know there's a lot of countries or, you know, your heritage that you get your influence from. Do you also look at other large cities or other major restaurants or bars or pastry bakeries that you get inspiration from as well?
I mean, for me, New York is definitely a top one. There's always such good stuff that's coming out of New York. And New York, very similar to Philadelphia, like for the most part, it's so hard and so like inundated with so many places to go that if you have a new space, like it better be good. So like that for me is a big part of it. And then being able to like be so close to it as well. Like a lot of times we'll see things like, you know, I obviously have a ton of like that comes up on my Instagram feed from Sicily. It makes me miss it every time I see it, but I cannot just go there if I want to, right? But if I see something that someone's putting up or there's like a new restaurant that just opened, it's like the attainability of it for me is big. So I think that's why I'm drawn to like that. Obviously DC too, but for me, I just like kind of, I prefer, I'm from New York State. I, you know, I like it there. Plus, I have family there. So
I had a meal at Core in London recently, and the dessert was, they called it the Core Teaser. It's like a malt teaser. It's like a malt ball inspired dessert. And one of the components was like this light but crunchy malt flavored bit that's supposed to be like the inside of the malt ball. And it just like melted in your mouth. I'm like, how do I do this? And that was like the inspiration for the honeycomb candy that is on the current dessert that I have on the menu. And I made like a honeycomb candy using baking soda like you traditionally would. And then we recently got an external vac seal chamber set up. And I was like, well, what if I put it in here and like pull all the air out? And it expanded a ton. But then it like collapses a little bit. I'm like, okay, so like I'll do it a second time. I think I did it like 30 times before I finally figured out like at what time, like after this many minutes, I'll do it the first time. After this many more minutes, I'll do it the second time. And finally got it to like that texture. And it's like, so just like going out to eat for me and like trying different things. And it's not always like pastry related things either. It's like, oh, I love this component on this dish. I love the way the sauce is plated. And just like going out in those lived experiences.
Yeah. I think you're completely right. I think that what is missed a lot of times in the conversation is that you have to go out and eat. Like social media has definitely opened our, you know, our windows to and our doors.
The world.
To the world. I also have a lot of Instagram accounts I follow in Puerto Rico. And I see it and I'm like, wow, but I want to go.
It's closer than Sicily. But,
it is. You know. It is way closer. You know, so you get to see a lot from many different places around the world. But there is absolutely, positively nothing that inspires me more than sitting down and having a great meal. And it not necessarily moves me to go and work, let's say, with Blood Orange, because I had your fantastic upside down cake, right? It just simply just sparks something in me that just tells me I am now in search for this. Either it is the technique like you were expressing, or it's this flavor or this combination of flavors that I want to achieve. And a lot of times that happens because you grabbed a good bite. And it could be anything. It could be a solid cheesesteak, but you know, maybe it's something way much more high end. I think that a lot of the inspiration that I draw, yes, is the traditions, not only mine, but even others, finding parallels in other cultures that give me this, there's this inquisitive nature in oneself that you just want to see, well, how are we all connected? How is it that this traveled from one place to the other? Not to go too long, but there is not a single meal in Puerto Rico that doesn't get served with rice at the table. But rice is from way, 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 way far from Puerto Rico. Plantains are a staple of our cuisine. We make everything with it. It's what corn is to Mexican cuisine. And yet, it's from Southeast Asia originally. So there are these natural clashes of culture that have existed from centuries sure. ago, and now they are what we recognize as our own, as a real thing that it is. And I truly believe that those things move forward, traditions and culture move forward when we go out and we enjoy someone else's, and then that drives us to do something new for ourselves.
AI, how do you see that in your industry?
I mean, if it's going to place my orders for me, I'm cool with it.
I don't know. I personally think that there's not, I'm not really into it. I think maybe I've seen Terminator too many times, but you know, the fact that Starlink actually exists and is named Starlink is concerning. But separately from that, I think food is something that we have as people that is one of the only things that everyone does. as human beings. Like, everyone has to eat, right? And being able to find those parallels and those corollaries between so many of our different, not only our physical restaurants, but the cultures that we like to embrace and enjoy and everyone else around the world. It's something that, like, as soon as you know, for lack of a better word, as soon as you dehumanize that, it's like, I don't know. I find that's like a little scary, to be quite honest with you. I'm sure it has a place. Again, like, if it was to be able to place my orders for me, I think that's great. But the thing for me, one of the things I love most about cooking is the human interaction and the human connection and like the human element of it. Like, it cannot exist without people. Like, I have to feed you and you have to want to eat. Like, I could make a bunch of food, but if nobody's hungry, then it doesn't matter, right? But if you're hungry and there's nobody to cook you food, then you got to figure it out. So the mutually exclusive relationship that we have with people, I don't think should be.
But think about it. Like, let's say, for instance, in tomorrow, you have a database that you can, you know, access. And you were talking to us before about like Blood Orange, for instance. And then, you know, a platform can help you and say, hey, here's like in 2 seconds, you know, what like all the flavors, like the other flavors that you can pair well with Blood Orange. And that can save you maybe years of experiments.
I don't know. I feel like I worked really hard to be able to get to that point to know that. I put a lot of effort into it. I think if a computer program told it to me, I don't think it's the same, because you're not learning firsthand. You're not tasting it. You're just some computer program is telling you that Agent Pear and Blood Orange go together, or Batarga and Blood Orange get together. And like, you wouldn't know that unless you actually did it and tried it. And the experience is the most important part about it, and it takes that away.
Okay. Very, very true. Very, very true. Here's the deal. Yes, there must be a place. There is going to be a place. This thing, it's on. It's happening.
It's not coming back.
Nobody's going to stop
it. Yeah.
But once it gives you all those pairings, right, it's also not giving you a lot of other pairings. And because your trust has been given completely to the machine, then you're not going to even look at the idea of pairing black pepper with your yogurt, and then nobody ever tries it, right? And it is in that trial and error that the beauty of it truly comes. I don't chefs and many other creatives are in the business of failing a lot of times just so that we can succeed this one time. I mean, I am sure that cakes, I don't touch them. Angelica makes the cake here, you know, and that's our business. There is a trial and error, and there's the error is just as important.
We are going to end here. I'm sorry. I would love to continue the conversation, but I think we have an agenda that to continue as well. You know, our tasting. I just want to thank you so much for your time. I would love to continue the conversation, and hopefully maybe we'll do it another time. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for all the great food that you shared with us, you know, during this few days in Philadelphia, and as well sharing your, you know, insights with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in into the Flavors Unknown podcast. It was an absolute pleasure to uncover the rich tapestry of stories, inspirations, and culinary delights from our distinguished guest today. If you enjoyed this journey through Philadelphia's vibrant culinary scene, do us a favor, share this episode with a foodie friend or family member. Word of mouth is the most delicious way to bring new listeners to our table. And don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at flavorsunknown.com to ensure you never miss an episode filled with the unknown flavors from around the culinary world. Until next time, keep exploring the unknown. And until then, keep in mind that the people who likes to eat are always the best people.
Thanks for listening to Flavors Unknown. If you've enjoyed this episode, give us a follow on Instagram at Flavors Unknown and visit us at flavorsunknown.com. Don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts.